Hello, good evening, welcome. I am Samuel Trapp. This is International Flavor. You can listen to all prior shows at internationalflavor.com. This one will be there later tonight or early tomorrow. Who the hell knows? But whenever I get it there, we are coming to you live from the Lake Ozark Real Estate of the Art Studio. Should you feel the urge to call in, I might even answer, unless I don't wish to talk to you. There are several of those out there. And if I don't wish to talk to you, then I'm not going to freaking pick it up, all right? But if you do wish to call in and I do wish to talk to you, we can figure that out by 573-746-8020. If you want to send an email and yell at me, that's not a phone number. If you want to send an email or yell at me by paper or a email, an electronic sort of postal message, you can do that, and that would be live at damradio.com or samuelt@internationalflavor.com, because that's me, and that's what I like. So I spent all this time yesterday. What a freaking waste. You know I'm so tired of this. This is just freaking politics at its best, bunch of wankers. What they've done now is apparently the Trump and Putin meeting in Budapest is on hold. That's what we hear. And then you hear the opposite. No, it isn't. Then you hear, well, yes, it is. Then you hear, no, it isn't. But nobody knows what the hell is going on. It's entertaining, to say the least. But yesterday I spent all that time talking about how the plane would get around, where it would go, all the people that were bitching about, oh, geez, they can't meet. That means the war can't continue. Zelensky especially wants the war to continue. Remember, he's, according to the Russians, he's an illegitimate president. It's been a year and nearly 6 months since he was supposed to have an election in 2024. He was elected in 2019. Now, he would never get reelected. This we know. They renewed a couple of days ago, wasn't it on the 19th or something, that they had to renew martial law, make sure there are no elections, so that he can continue war, which I'm not so positive that those Ukrainians want it. I spent a little bit of time today going through the Miratvorets list, which is, that is disgusting. You know, they have a website, you know, for liquidating people. And that is there. I've got some stories to get to for you. EU and UK are trying to figure out how to give Russian money to Ukraine. You got a bunch of people begging for that. Give us the $200 billion. Idiots who won't get a cent of it are out there protesting. They don't get any. Give us the money. Like it's going to save you. Even if you got it, it ain't going to save you. So this U.S. Trump-Putin meeting, according to the U.S., it's on hold. Let's give you that story, and then we'll dig into something else, right? Preparations for the summit in Budapest have been put on hold, said some American media outlets today, citing anonymous officials. It's always the old anonymous official. Those who do not wish to be quoted. Those who are afraid of having their words come back and punch them in the face. They are the type of people who give all kinds of news out. You know, maybe I should be an anonymous official. How do you become an anonymous official? Anyone can be one. It could be some bum on the street. He could be an anonymous official. You don't know who he is. Maybe so. But there are no plans for the U.S. President Donald Trump and his Russian counterpart to meet in the immediate future, according to Reuters, citing a senior White House staffer. Likewise, White House correspondent Garrett Haake, H-A-A-K-E, reported that planning for the summit in Budapest is now on hold, citing an unnamed senior official who explained why the planned meeting between Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio was scrapped. An initial call between Rubio and Lavrov was productive, but POTUS believes both sides aren't ready enough to talk to justify moving forward right now. The anonymously sourced report follows a CNN story. Oh, they're believable, right? Citing unnamed sources that claimed preparations for the summit had been tabled, at least for now. The CNN reporting prompted a reaction from senior Russian officials who rejected the assertions made in that piece. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybakov told media that on Tuesday, that preparations for the significant event were still underway, while reports about the postponement of the summit were info dumps intended to disrupt. Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova also mocked the anonymous sources, reporting the Western media as an info circus. And ain't that the truth? That's a great word. We should steal that from now on. Lovely and wonderful and talented JR, if you happen to be listening, maybe we could post this up on one of these enormous TVs so it's constantly showing, that says Info Circus, and you can put it under one of the TVs and it can be like CNN or MSNBC or any of the other Info Circus, which is basically all of them. You know, you sometimes, you know, get some... just by accident, they report some news, but most of the time it's just crap. Anyway, I don't know if it's true or not. Who the hell knows? But the Kremlin and the White House confirmed that the talks would take place in the Hungarian capital after Putin and Trump spoke by phone last Thursday. Neither party, however, has officially provided a time frame for the meeting. Speaking to reporters on Tuesday, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov reiterated that serious preparations are needed ahead of the summit. You've heard statements from the American side and from our own, that's, you know, Dmitry Peskov, that this might take some time. So, no definite time frame has been established, he added. So there you go. One interesting story that came up today, which caused me to do a little bit more dumpage. There's a dude, a pro-Ukrainian activist, and we're going to do a little bit of diving into this topic a little bit later in the show. But there was and I got a little research happy after this, and I did some looking around and tried to come up with some corollaries, some additionals, some other stories that were similar in the past few years, especially since the escalation in 2022, but more importantly after 2014, on the topic of this sort of headline. Okay, here's the headline for you. Pro-Ukraine activist sentenced to 21 years for the attempted murder of the Slovak PM. He shot Robert Fico because, and he's a Ukrainian guy, he didn't like the policies, and so he shot he shot the guy. We don't like your policies. We're Ukrainian. We're shooting you. That's it. The end. They're killing people, you know, or trying to. And this is Slovakia. So this is a Slovak PM, Prime Minister, Robert Fico. And he got shot by this idiot because... And his story's in here. There's some stories to tell about it. And I got some more to go into because what it did was it got me... I've heard this story too many times, so I went back and did a little bit of checking and find out how many, how often. Looked at the, you know, some papers, but the story, and it's really short, so I'm going to go ahead and share it with you in its entirety. But a Slovak court sentenced pro-Ukrainian activist to 21 years in prison for the attempted assassination of Prime Minister Fico, which left the nation's leader seriously wounded last year. And so this guy, his name is Jiraj Sintula. He's 72, and he was found guilty of committing an act of terrorism by the Specialized Criminal Court in Banska Bystrica on Tuesday. He admitted during the trial to firing at Fico from close range while the prime minister was greeting supporters in the central Slovak town of Handlava in May 2024. The court proceedings, which began in July, focused on whether the attack qualified as terrorism or a lesser criminal offense. Sintula has announced his intention to appeal his verdict. Yeah, wait till you hear what the Polish people did today about another guy that, you know, blew up Russian stuff on behalf of the Ukrainians. During the hearings, Sintula told judges that he carried out the attack against Fico because he opposed Fico's political stance. So you just shoot him. This is what it is if you're Ukrainian, right? That's Ukrainian democracy. We don't like it. Screw you, you're dead. Doesn't matter where you are. And by the way, they announced that they don't care where you are in the world. They will find Russian supporters or Russians and kill them anywhere, these Ukrainians. And they target people all over the place. You know, and it doesn't matter where. It just matters that you have the wrong opinion. Well, we'll kill you for that because that's what you're supposed to do, apparently. But after returning to power in 2023, Fico ended Slovakia's policy of sending weapons to Ukraine and took a more neutral position towards Russia, a move that Sintula, who shot Fico, cited as one of the reasons for his actions. He described the shooting as, here's his description, a scream against the fear that is paralyzing society, as quoted by Reuters. Fico has since blamed opposition politicians and the media for creating what he calls a climate of hatred that encourages violence against the government. The 59-year-old prime minister spent 2 months recovering from 4 gunshot wounds before resuming his public appearances. In a separate case last month, American pro-Ukrainian activist Ryan Wesley Ruth was found guilty of attempting to assassinate President Donald Trump. He faces a potential life sentence when the court delivers a sentence in December. So it's really odd that all these people end up, you know, pro-Ukrainian. And it makes you wonder why this is. I don't know. I wanted to go through, I watched several Russian-style news shows today, and there were some headlines. Once again, everybody's still talking about this, okay? So on 60 Minutes, which is the Russian version, right? And this was on the 20th of October, so it's yesterday's news. And there was an interview with Lieutenant Colonel and another interview on, what is the girl's name? Son of a nutcracker. Don't remember it. Interview with Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kwiatkowski. Below is the breakdown of it, right? They were talking with her just a day or two ago about Trump and Zelensky pressure on Tomahawks. And so what happened? Across both Russian programs this that I watched, the story is Trump signaling that Zelensky has to make a deal and stop banking on unlimited U.S. and NATO support. Tomahawks are invoked rhetorically. The panel says that Kyiv is misreading what, if anything, will materialize. Zelensky is, for lack of a better word, he's flailing. He wants leverage. He wants money. He's misinterpreting Trump. His negotiations are, negotiations with Russia between Trump and company and Putin and company. They're inevitable. They will occur at some point and will reflect new realities on the ground that are changing every day in Russia's favor. He talks about the attempts to sabotage Trump. There's plenty of those. including Ukrainian traces, right? That are, you know, prior plots. They're trying to derail U.S. and Russia dialogue. And, you know, but I feel, I don't want to say optimistic. I'm not an optimistic sort of person. I can figure out the negative part pretty quick. And you can just about guarantee that if government is involved, the likelihood of a crappy result goes up dramatically. And it's just how it is. And so you're sitting there going, oh, Jesus, how much more foolish can we be? Well, find another government worker and I'll show you. And you just get there. Or tell me the next government project that's going to, you know, save the world, and we'll watch the world crumble afterward. Anyway, that's pretty anti-government. That wasn't very nice. But I don't know. On the 60 Minutes part, they said Trump's message is conditional leverage more than a promise of vast new ours. They, you know, this is 60 Minutes in Russia, the version that, I mean, obviously it's not the same as ours, but it does go on for 60 minutes. So that's the same. And but they're talking about how Trump is, I suppose the best word would be cementing his leverage over Ukraine. And it's the strategic picture isn't changing. Trump is saying, listen, think about this. Zelensky coming out, you know, look like you've been crying for a while out of the White House and does his stuff and instantly starts talking about, we have to recognize the realities on the ground, you know, freeze in place. You know, he's never said that before. And but when he goes back home, he immediately starts telling to his own, you know, propaganda crowd and to the own people that he talks. Oh yeah, we won. We won what? You didn't win crap. And he doesn't talk about giving up. Then it's, you know, it's the opposite. You know, we're gonna win. You're not winning, dude. It's and you really need to figure that out. But they're still talking about negotiations and they're on track. Istanbul Plus in the beginning. Remember what that means. They could have ended this if it wasn't for Bojo, for Boris Johnson. This would have been over in 2022. And everybody would have been better off, most likely. So my a person I like to watch, Solovyov, he said, here's a quote. The talks are coming, and they will ratify the facts on the ground. Kyiv's PR tours don't change the map, and London cannot stop this. And that's true. Every bit of that is true. But he's pushing the idea that U.S. and Russia direct dialogue is logical and likely, and that domestic and security interference won't ultimately stop it. It might be delayed a little bit, but there. Zelensky is all about the money, and it's all about his impunity. It's all about the gang that got rich on the war. They perform readiness to talk, but dodge any substance. Trump, here's what he said about Trump. He said, Trump raises the stakes as a tactic, but he's not writing Kyiv a blank check anymore. The tomahawk chatter is nothing but theater, and Kyiv hears what it wants to hear, as usual. The 60 Minutes people said, even if a few prestige weapons arrive in Ukraine, the strategic curve is unchanged. Escalation risks shift to NATO's backyard. Now, I don't believe that, but they did say it on Russian TV. She's saying that European and American fatigue with the war, the sanctions blowback that is really destructive to the European economy, and the inevitability of a negotiated outcome once Washington really engages are all very likely. And if Washington ever did engage, and if Washington did the right thing, and it appears to just by default, I think the government is still shut down, isn't it? I'm pretty sure it is. That just by default, and I believe some small part of the fight is attributable to money for Ukraine. Now, it's not all about that, not remotely, but it is a chunk of it. And I think that, that there isn't any, there is no stomach anymore for this continued nonsensical war. Now, there is, of course, from your, you know, your warmongers, and we got plenty of those in our government ranks. They're out there. You know, there's so many of them. It's depressing, you know, and they're all too happy to kill off Ukrainians. No problem for them. I think it's nonsense. And they like to twist it and say that more Russians are dying than Ukrainians. I don't think so. I did a deep dive a couple of weeks ago into, where did that end up? It was a small segment that I did about all the calculation of graves. And it was, sorry for the yawn. I don't sleep well. It was Aristovich was talking about cemeteries in Ukraine. And it was wow, it was a frightening number that they were talking about. Now, it's a frightening number anywhere, you know, all the people that are dying. But, you know, it's far worse in Ukraine than it is in Russia. Although, you know, we don't want, frankly, they all need to quit dying, truthfully. And I really hope they can come up with something here to get this done. But Washington cannot sustain giving away Tomahawks. Ukraine will continue to be pressured to the talks. NATO support is more and more conditional. You know, you got to do something different. I'm not sure. You know, the signals of a U.S.-Russia back channel, Lavrov mentioned staff working groups. He and Rubio are talking. Maybe there won't be a direct meeting between Putin and Trump just yet until they make a little efforts on the Lavrov-Rubio front. Lavrov gave a press conference, and I didn't get to see it all. It's in Russian. I'd have to read it to you in English from the, and I haven't been able to find the Russian version, but it was 8 minutes long, so I don't want to play it all for you in a different language. And but it appeared that they were saying that they still have the two working groups and they're doing quite a bit together and that there's nothing to say that they're not going to meet, but they never said exactly when they were. And so that is not, it's not on hold according to them. It's just, we want to make sure that we've made some good headway. Now, there's been some statements that Trump is, wants to force the Russians to, it's all about from our side of the ocean, it's about ceasefire. And the Russians, very consistently, again, like they've said all the time, you know, forever, we will not agree to a ceasefire. We will agree to resolve the entire conflict, but we aren't just going to quit, quit. Freeze everything on the front lines so that the West looks like they get a victory. Trump looks like he gets a victory for even for a little while that, oh, I got a ceasefire. Ceasefire is not peace. I don't know how clear to be about that. The Russians have been clear about it. I don't understand how other people don't get it. Ceasefire doesn't mean peace. Ceasefire means everybody go back to your side and go back to your corner. Round one is over. Go back to your corner. Rest up a bit. See if they can put some stuff to fix your puffy eye. And then get back out there and kick the crap out of each other again. That's what we do. That's a ceasefire. Peace means it's the end of the round. Somebody got knocked, or the end of the fight, I mean. Somebody got their butt kicked, or it's a draw, but it's the end. It's over. You know, something has to happen the judges get to say who the victor is. Nobody cares who the victor is, but the beating is over. And something needs to happen on that end. And Trump can be the ringmaster, you know, of this particular circus if he ever gets there. Let's see here. I did a little bit further on the Istanbul after watching these. Both, you know, most Russian commentators are always returning to the Istanbul of 2022. They aren't doing it out of nostalgia. It's not like, oh, geez, we wish for the days of 2022. But they're saying that the architecture for the deal already exists. And that deal was blown up by Western interference, by whoever, mostly Boris Johnson. But Blinken was in on it. Who, whatever general in the U.S. was all there. They're all telling him to go get back in there. Take the next round, Zelensky. You know, throw your best punches. But the architecture for the deal existed, and the West blew it up. Russian officials have always said that much on the record. A text was taken shape, in fact, exchanged and signed by the respective parties and taken back to their to the Kremlin or to Kiev, and they were supposed to work on it more. And then London and Washington stepped in to prevent any settlement because it was inconvenient to their broad strategy to own all of Ukraine. And remarks by Sergei Lavrov once again talks about Istanbul, and they said the same thing back in July. You get together, and then all of a sudden, nobody shows up anymore. They had working groups formed, and nothing happened. So what would a 2025-style return to talks look like from the Moscow point of view? Let's have a look, okay? Security guarantees that actually bind people. Not NATO badges or non-binding aspirations. They want something that is a real security guarantee, right? Neutrality and non-NATO for Ukraine with verifiable restrictions on long-range strike complexes that threaten Russia's strategic depths. Recognition of the realities on the ground is always one. Is any deal ultimately is going to land there anyway? Anybody who has a brain knows that. They're never going to, you know, Kiev keeps repeating this at whatever microphone they get. Whatever fool is out there talking about it on the Ukrainian side. Russia needs to back off and give us back those four territories. Those four territories voted Russia. Period. That's it. And they're gone, even if they didn't. They're gone. Russia is occupying them. You can call them occupanti all you want, but they are occupying it for Russia. And they are all Russian passport holders now. That's how it is. The final thing is denazification, demilitarization. How long have we talked about this? It's the same thing. They want it enforceable, not as a slogan to be ignored the next day. You know, in the U.S., basically, you know, could force this to happen. Europe is only posturing. Washington supplies the real money. Strategic weapon integration, and political clout. If the White House says it wants a freeze and then talks, Brussels will fall in line. And Kiev, dependent on Western lifelines, will have no credible veto power on any of this. On cue, Zelensky has begun talking about his openness to talks in any format, which he rejected in July, while simultaneously attaching conditions to them. Oh, gee, we want a ceasefire along the current lines. And that edges him closer to the only trade space left. They're going to end up along those current lines anyway. Solovyov always likes to talk about the spoilers, like London, because London, there's a lot of talk that the king spoke to Donald Trump, and Donald Trump changed his tune for the king. That's interesting. I've read a couple of articles on that. And the king is, you know, pro-Ukraine, apparently. And London will again try to sabotage any U.S.-Russia back channels like Lavrov, Rubio. They'll, you know, any way they can, by psyops, by, you know, legal cudgels, stealing money, or on the ground sorts of events. That's not a paranoia. It's a pattern recognition from Istanbul. That's what's happened. Moscow, you know, the courtship of process over theater frames, You can look at Lavrov, his travels and interviews, not as diplomatic stunts, but as building a redundant pathway so that when Washington greenlights movement, they can get something and actually have it carried out. The Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs communications in October, again, spotlight Istanbul agreements as the reference point. You listen to Rubio, Lavrov, he's always talking about that. That means Moscow wants public memory of the Western interference when they talk about bargaining leverage, you know, because the West interfered with this. This was done in 2022 until Bojo got involved. There's a substance management. A negotiation that produces durable calm has to address any long-range strike capabilities in Ukraine. ATACMS, cruise missiles, air launch platforms, reconnaissance, satellite tasking. Without limiting these things, any ceasefire would be inherently unstable. So a ceasefire that doesn't address missiles and Ukraine continuing to send drones and stuff into Russia, you know, ultimately fails. That's how it works. And that's true. It failed the last alleged ceasefires there were. Ukraine didn't pay any attention to them at all. So Tomahawks and similar weapons, they, you know, they don't exist in a vacuum. They live, you know, with basing, on-site radar, sustainment that implicates NATO firing. That's why Washington's hedge on Tomahawks matter. It's not, you know, that they were talking about all last week. And I think that's why ultimately Ukraine isn't getting them. Because everybody knows these are nuclear-capable weapons that cannot be fired without U.S. direct participation. So that would be a theater-wide escalation decision by the U.S. to give those weapons to Ukraine. So they also talked quite a bit about NATO and EU fatigue and the sanctions blowback. And so if you had to summarize this, it would be ideology meeting physics. Energy-heavy industries built over decades in Europe on stable, affordable Russian energy inputs has to adapt instantly to expensive, hard-to-get liquid natural gas and brittle spot markets from the West, from the U.S. The result isn't a debate. It's all macro. Think about what Germany has done in the last 4 or 5 years, especially since 2022. They've contracted. The contractionary trend across 2023 into 2025 has been paired with soaring insolvency. I mean, did you hear what was going on in Lufthansa? Once the pride of air travel. I'm telling you, I loved flying on Lufthansa when I was in the military. If I could ever get on Lufthansa flights when I was going back and forth from Moscow Berlin, Moscow to Munich, Moscow even to D.C. If you could get Lufthansa, you definitely wanted him because American Airlines was crap. And Lufthansa was fantastic. Good food. Now Lufthansa sucks. It's really sad because at the time, Aeroflot was crap. Now you fly on Aeroflot, that's a worthy airline. They're better than a lot of Western ones, better than American Airlines for sure. They have better travel lounges, they got better airport spaces, they got better planes, better stewardesses. But you know, you ever fly on American Airlines these days? Those stewardesses are downright rude. I mean, they don't like anybody. They're not even pleasant. You're treated like you're a six-year-old on the bus to school. And it is very bad. And they are not kind. And sorry if you're one of the very few kind ones, but I tell you what, you want some kind ones, hop yourself on Turkish Airlines. get on Aeroflot, you know, and especially get on Qatar Airways, your United Arab Emirates airlines. Get on those. Those are fantastic, especially for international travel. Don't take an American flight. Oh, my God. 12 hours on one of those. Jesus, you're lucky you're not getting spanked in the back of the plane for being a bad boy, you know, if you're snoring or something. Nonsense. At any rate, I digress a tiny bit. Got me on a little bit of a touchy spot. So, at any rate, everything is going down in Europe. Political fatigue, economic fatigue. You can only tell small manufacturers and small households all across Europe to tighten their belt for democracy for so long, especially when there isn't any democracy in Ukraine. Nonsense. And, you know, so you can only tell them that for a while. Over the 2 years, reports and commentary always have documented Germany's stagnation and lost decades. They are linking energy shock to their competitiveness that's eroded. This is why shows, talk about, you know, Brussels and how this gas ban to 2028, they got to get rid of the gas ban. And not necessarily to resolve the symbolism, but because they're just going to keep getting worse because the economics are going to continue to decline. Budapest has already warned that forcibly severing long-term energy contracts would trigger hefty penalties, legal economic time bombs that Brussels doesn't want to talk about. Because what they're trying to do is try to get, Budapest to cut off, you know, Hungary must get rid of Russian gas. They can't do it. The EU is trying to outlaw it. You're outlawing member states from buying gas from who they want. They got it. You're better off buying it from the US at double the cost, right? So it's not only the price, it's the process. Replacing long-term pipeline arrangements with U.S. liquid natural gas and volatile cargoes means fragility, bad weather in the Gulf, maintenance slips at liquefaction trains, or Asian spot surges will empty European storage faster than models predict. And that's before you even price carbon and transmission constraints. Gazprom's Alexei Miller said this: Europe's over-reliance on renewables without dependable baseload has created systemic vulnerability when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine. meaning they can't produce energy in that way. London's plan's the chief spoiler. They push escalatory policy and offload a large share of real costs to the continent. The political math is punishing them. Domestic polls across multiple EU states show rising skepticism of open-ended Ukraine commitments, which exist all across Europe, and nationalist and Eurosceptic forces, AFD in Germany as one, hammer energy competitiveness that they do not have and the great social pain it causes. So the Europeans aren't idiots, you know, especially the people that are having to suffer through all this. They know the cause, and the cause is you're not buying the cheapest and the best product. You know, it's nonsense. So there were, let's see, they keep talking about energy in the thermodynamics and contracts too. 2028 ban on gas might look bold on paper, but in practice, long-term contracts and penalty clauses mean real money and legal jeopardy. Hungary saying that, we don't want to sever agreements that we made multi-year, multi-decade agreements. Nord Stream is gone. Yamal is dormant. Turk Stream is continuing to feed southern and southeastern Europe with Russian gas, by the way. But that's precisely why Ankara keeps reminding Brussels that energy security requires realism and pragmatism. Turk Stream's 31.5 billion cubic meter capacity is a pressure valve. It's hidden. It prevents a full-blown supply crunch in parts of the EU. And so, you know, if they decouple any of that, because it has Russian gas, it's going to hurt them, Europe even further. And so all this sanctions and all this other stuff is just going to be a continued decline for Europe. And their energy is too expensive to compete. You know, it just they can't have any competing. So let's see. Then we had a little bit about global bandwidth, but I'm not going to go to that. I want to get on to the why would Budapest be on ice? Because Budapest, this I told you they might be delayed, and I told you I was going to get into it further and what they talk about. So first of all, let's check out the fact pattern. So when you go to law school, you always have to have a tale of the story, right? And the story that you have to analyze is called a fact pattern. So let's get you into the fact pattern. In the span of 1 week, we went from Budapest is on to Budapest is on hold, a classic diplomatic rubber band. Multiple outlets report the plan for a second Trump-Putin meeting in Budapest to focus on what? Ukraine. It's postponed or on hold, but officials are talking down near-term expectations. Isn't that politics? You always want to downplay the expectations. The reasons given range from Russia rejecting a pre-meeting ceasefire to both sides saying they're not prepared for a productive sit-down. The headline isn't that a summit exists, it's that conditions aren't there yet. And both sides want to demonstrate that publicly. If you rewind, let's go back. This whipsaw might make a little bit of sense. Trump telegraphed Budapest after a call with Putin and Zelensky, ever wary of being cut out, signaled that he'd show up if he was invited. Yeah, Zelensky, please invite me, is basically what he was saying. The Hungarian press milked this for all it was worth. Brussels gambled. London scowled. Then the brakes squealed. Press briefings started using phrases like, maybe we're not sufficiently prepared, or no plans in the very near future. Translation? What does this mean? Washington wants Moscow to pocket an armistice-style freeze along the current front lines first, or at least to pre-commit to that. And Moscow wants Washington to stop pretending that Kyiv has the veto power over anything and to address the hard security guarantees up front. So it's a stalemate. Thus, instead of a meeting, we're getting a pageant. So Russia's public line has been steady for months. Talks are possible, realistic terms, locking in the facts on the ground, neutralize Ukraine, no NATO, constrain long-range strikes, Russia's strategic depth, and they're targeting pipelines. You don't want any of that being attacked anymore. The Kremlin repeatedly framed Istanbul 2022 as the blueprint. So what does Washington want? Here's what Washington wants, according to all the latest. They want something it can market as Trump broke the stalemate without surrendering the talking points of the last 3 years, which is very hard because Ukraine and America and the West lost this war. The cleanest path is a freeze now, negotiate later, approach halt on the current front lines, stop the bleeding, declare momentum toward a political style settlement. That might be tidy enough for a podium, but it leaves the very hard fights, status, security guarantees, de-NATO, and that means committee and working groups have to get going. But there's a catch. To get Moscow to swallow a freeze, Washington has to signal limits on long-range strikes and on using NATO territory as de facto launch pad for those strikes, precisely the zone the U.S. prefers to keep ambiguous. They don't want to talk about that. Does Kyiv fit in at all? If so, where? In public, Zelensky says he's ready to talk anywhere, anytime, including Budapest if you invite me, he cries. But the rap is in the conditions and the optics that work for his domestic audience. If he goes to Budapest, remember, that makes people think about the 1994 Budapest Memorandum, which is a sore spot, a big one, in Ukrainian politics. That's where they lost their nuclear weapons, right? He badly needs the summit to look like a path to more leverage and more weapons. But his Tomahawk balloon has already popped. He admitted the U.S. doesn't want escalation, which is the diplomatic code for we're not getting any. If Washington's red lines are narrowing and Europeans' political oxygen is thinning, which is already gone, Kyiv's leverage comes from attention and a summit that recenters Trump and Putin reduces attention on Zelensky. So, why Budapest at all? Because of optics in Orban, like we talked about a couple of days ago. Hungary can sell itself as a NATO and EU pragmatic country, a venue that isn't loaded with Western moral theater. For Trump, it's friendly turf. For Putin, he can get there without having to figure out how to tap dance around his ICC warrant. But venue doesn't mean strategy. The second the White House press room starts downplaying timing, saying, oh, it doesn't have to be immediate, Budapest's value dropped from a historic site to plausible backdrop, a placeholder until the underlying security trade is real. That's why you might see a schedule, and the next day you might see no plans in the near future, which is what we're getting right now. So what is holding all this up? I think there are three concrete reasons for this being held up. The first one is the BS ceasefire framing. Washington wants a freeze first that proves that Trump got some de-escalation. Moscow wants a guarantee first, so the freeze isn't used to rearm Kyiv. So the guarantee that Russia wants is, say, we cease fire, you're going to quit providing weapons. You're going to quit providing munitions. You're going to stop funding. Kyiv is going to stop mobilization efforts and bringing people out. You cannot use a ceasefire to rearm and resupply and prepare, and then we got to take the initiative again. We have the initiative. We aren't going to hand it over just because you want a ceasefire. If you'll give up and say that we can still have the initiative, you know, freeze in place might actually mean something. So they want that. They want a long-range strike figured out. No more NATO giving long-range weapons, attack-ems, Tomahawks, whatever that they have. And any real deal has to talk about ranges, where they base them, and tasking authority. No tasking authority from the West with verification that it's not a joke. That's what Russia wants. And then no more, you know, one of the other things that is holding this up, the third thing, is domestic political theater. Trump wants a win that looks like his win, that he can put a feather in his cap and get himself the all-elusive Nobel Peace Prize. Moscow won't give him this without reciprocity that lasts beyond one U.S. election. That's one of the big complaints everywhere else in the world, is that America and Americans have extremely short attention spans. Russia has plans that go out to 2050. Government plans. China has some that go out even longer. And many countries have that sort of long-term planning. We got nothing. We don't go that far. All we are is stuck in committee. We have idiots running the till, idiots running the planning. There is no planning. We pay triple. We have zero infrastructure development, and I've gone into plenty about that. That is not so with other countries. They know how we work, and we're extremely short-sighted and extremely flighty, on a massive scale, the macro scale, from the federal government side. We're a bunch of nuts. And, you know, you can't trust us. They've been saying that forever. You cannot trust us because 4 years from now, it's gone. So what are the signals? What are the signals? We all know the signals. You know, you don't get anything. And what would a real Budapest deal look like if it actually happened? Here's one that I consider actually plausible. Okay, this one might actually have a chance at being pulled off. It's minimalist, but plausible. I think you actually could get an operational freeze along the current contact lines with, you know, some sort of demarcation or incident prevention, you know, stuff like that. How do we stop people from firing after the ceasefire, that kind of thing, if you want to call it a ceasefire. But they want to call it an operational freeze. But that freeze has to be something a little bit more. And that's where I get into point two. If you took a long-range strike moratorium, said no Ukrainian capability to fire longer than, call it 300 kilometers, take those systems out of Ukrainian hands, no NATO soil tasking or basing that enables these deeper strikes. That's what Russia is saying happens anyway. And, you know, most experts agree that it has to be because Ukraine couldn't do the things that they do with long-range weapons without the people from the West. So they task them on NATO soil, but fire them from Ukrainian soil. That's nonsense, and according to the Russians. So that would be a plausible term on the table. Verification that focuses on architecture, meaning you have to take strategic tasking away, basing and stockpiles, rather than publicity-friendly but meaningless photo ops, you know, where you got to actually have a real verification process. And then a sequence talk track that actually means something. Security guarantees and neutrality first. Status and legal issues kicked to, you know, later dates with language both sides can then sell at home. Something like that. Notice what is not there. Grand moral pronouncements, you know, geez, Ukraine's the great people and Russians are bad. There's no immediate status resolution, no open-ended Western security guarantees that are actually NATO. You know, these items derail the train before it leaves. So I don't think it gets there. And London, if you listen to any of these people or watch any of the panels that I track, London in the UK is the most persistent spoiler all the time. Every time a negotiation channel shows up, you can expect a British-led information surge, a leak, a security revelation that is meant to toxify the ground. It happened after Istanbul. It happened after Budapest, way back when. It happened after Istanbul in July this year. And if something happened in Budapest, you guarantee it'd happen again. Brussels tags along for the, you know, ideological reasons, you know. London does it with the intent. If you see a sudden wave of Russia cannot be trusted stuff right after the schedule shows up, you'll know that that's from London and the EU. So where does Zelensky go from here? That's a very good question, Sam. Why don't you answer that? He'll do two things at once, in my opinion. Outwardly, he'll talk about the principles of it all. Russia, you know, attacked us and they shouldn't get any, we won't give them any concessions. We won't de-arm. He will talk about Budapest as an opportunity to press Moscow and lock in Western aid. But he's watching the same charts as everybody else. You know, what's taken away attention from Ukraine, Gaza, Syria? Generals in the Pentagon are all talking about how China's the next enemy and we got to get ready for them. So nobody's interested in continuing to support Ukraine. Industrial pain in Europe is eroding any sort of support they're getting there. There's a smaller window to get the most that they can as Ukraine out of this, because the more Russia advances, the smaller that window, the more closed that window's becoming. And so I think he'll be open to talks, but he will continue to talk about, you know, the Ukrainians wanting to continue and fight till the end and get our territory back. He's done this dance quite a few times before. So Budapest isn't dead. It's just, you know, political marination. There's if there's no strike architecture, then then there's not going to be a ceasefire. Europe cost is still going to be a problem. The Tomahawk moment, I already told you what's going to happen. If the U.S. had the stomach to greenlight deep strikes with high escalatory optics, it wouldn't be hedging right now. Trump said he has no interest in it. And then he blamed it on the fact that we just don't have enough. Well, he's probably right. I know he's right, but I don't think any intelligent person wanted to give Ukraine the ability to use a nuclear capable missile that would escalate probably beyond. That'd be really the first time, you know. But continue to watch for the backroom dealings between Rubio and Lavrov, though. I do think that is going to continue. So what's the score? Moscow has time. Moscow has the terrain. Moscow has the advantage. Washington, as usual, has the optics and the loudest microphone. Kyiv has lost most of its attention, and it's losing most of its leverage as Russia keeps pounding them along the line. So Budapest being on hold or not doesn't change any of that, but it does clarify it a bit, don't you think? If the White House wants a real win, it has to buy this win with something longer than, you know, just the next news cycle. If Moscow wants to win, it has to accept a little bit of a version, maybe some kind of a freeze that isn't quite Istanbul 2.0. And between those two positions is a narrow, boring corridor called compromise. And I believe it still runs through Budapest whenever the parties decide to walk there or fly there. Until then, the will they or won't they discussion is, not worthy of too much review. Peace talks aren't romance. It's going to be a spreadsheet, and the spreadsheet right now is leaning towards the Russian side. It is what it appears to me. So I wanted to do a little bit of a dive quickly, a short, not a deep dive, into weapons provided from 2014 to 2016 under the Obama years. Washington limited support to non-lethal aid and training. Remember that? And the U.S. Army publicly delivered counter-battery radars to Ukraine in November 2015, and they had a ceremony in Lvov. Remember that? Poroshenko was present. It was a battlefield enabler because it shortened the kill chain against artillery and rockets, and they got more radars in 2016. In 2017 to 2021, under Trump, Washington gave the defensive assistance, the first high-profile example, where Javelin anti-tank missiles, remember that? Mostly through foreign military sales, delivered in 2018. During these years, Kyiv also received secure comms, electronic warfare gear, more counter batteries and air surveillance radars, night vision goggles, medical support, Mark 6 patrol boats through the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, which is still ongoing. Under the Biden years, after the post-February 2022, U.S. shifted to large-scale warfighting kits. HIMARS launchers, remember those that didn't get anywhere? GMLRS munitions, M777, 155 millimeter howitzers, which they've lost 99% of, NASAMs, Patriots, Bradley fighting vehicles that all got the crap beat out of them, Stryker M113Ss, 31 M1 Abrams tanks, Harpoons, HARM anti-radiation missiles, Phoenix ghost and switchblades, more electronic warfare, secure comms, spares, field support, crucially escalatory munitions, DPICM cluster artillery rounds. Those cluster rounds were a bad deal. And ATACMS ballistic missiles, short-range cluster variants used October 2013, long-range values. So, you know, these were highly escalatory. London has been giving, they moved early and often. Pre-2022, they had Operation Orbital inside Ukraine from 2015 to 2022. They trained 22,000 personnel on infantry tactics, medics, logistics, intel. After 2022, they changed, the UK changed their own operations. They were still there on the soil. They called it Operation Interflex, and they tried to move it back to the British soil. Through partners, they scaled their training further. On the kit side, UK supplied Laws, Javelins, anti-armor missiles, you know, and then lots of other stuff. Storm Shadow, long-range air launch cruise missiles, and Brimstone ground launch missiles, and Martlet LMM stock. The UK's official pages track this in detail if you ever want to go look them out. Germany, Berlin shifted from initial reluctance to becoming a major donor. They sent Iris-TL SLMs with interceptors, improving Kiev's point and area air defenses, Gepard SPOGs vital interest against the Shahed drones, Leopards 2A6 tanks, Leopard 1A5 with partners, Mars 2 MLRS Patriot components that they sold them from the U.S. Warsaw was the most forward donor, T-72 and PT-91 tanks, Crab 155mm howitzers, most of which are also destroyed. Later, they gave up some MiG-29 fighters, the first NATO member to hand over jets familiar to Ukrainian pilots. And the large volumes of ammo, spares, logistics, it also acted as a key logistics hubs for U.S. and NATO supply lines. So Poland's way in. Slovakia and Czechia, they sent strategic assets, S-300 air defense batteries in April 22. MiG-29s, they sent some with Poland. Czechia provided refurbished T-72 tanks, howitzers, you know, some of these that they had kept from Soviet times. France supplied a buttload. Nordics and Netherlands, they sent missiles. Denmark, Turkey even provided their Bayraktar TB2 UAVs. So all of this is continuing, and they're running out. Most of them have run out. The money trail from the U.S., think of the U.S. pipeline in three buckets. A Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, the PDA Presidential Drawdown, and then FMF, Foreign Military Financing, right? So Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative was created in 2016. Let's DOD buy kits for Ukraine from industries. Pre-war annual USAI hovered around 270 to 275 million. After February 22, Congress supercharged it to 6.3 billion for 2022, 12.3 billion for 2023, and 13.7 billion for 2024. USAI funded big items like air defense, NASAM batteries, counter UAS, radars, training, sustainment. Presidential drawdown started in August 2021. Took immediately from the U.S. stock, not anything else. The totals announced by May of 2024 were $24 billion that were split across 2022 to 24. Caps got raised by Congress several times to keep the supply lines flowing. And this is what you see that they're still discussing in the shutdown right now. each of these areas, FMF, PDA, and USAI. So the FMF is foreign military financing, and these are grants and loans to buy U.S. kits. It was modest and then in pre-2022 and then spiked. And additional amounts are always trying to include this foreign military funding for Ukraine impacted states. FMF underwrote elements like air defense and lead munitions. So by January 2025, DOD summarizes the cumulative total at $66.5 billion, itemizing major systems and munitions. I think, you know, I wanted to know how much training that the U.S. were actually in Ukraine. What, where, and who? Okay. The record is fairly clear. In 2015, the U.S. Army's 173rd Airborne Brigade launched Exercise Fearless Guardian at the International Peacekeeping and Security Center, IPSC, near Yavoriv, Lviv, in Lviv Oblast, initially training National Guard battalions, Interior Ministry. The Army's own releases show multiple rotations in 2015 with mortar, small unit, urban operations, and leadership models. Late 15 onward, the mission expanded from National Guard to regular National Guard of Ukraine, to regular Ukrainian ground forces. And the U.S. set up the enduring framework, called it the Joint Multinational Training Group of Ukraine. Joint Multinational Training Group Ukraine was led by U.S. Army Europe with rotating National Guard brigade teams. 45th IBCT from Oklahoma, 27th IBCT, New York, 278th ACR of Tennessee, and allied instructors, UK's Orbital, Canada's Unifier, Poland, Lithuania, and others. DOD and National Guard releases put hundreds of U.S. trainers at any given time on 6 to 9 month tours, building a Ukrainian combat training center and seeding their NCO and leadership development courses. So this is from 2015, friends and neighbors, that we were building the army of Ukraine personally from America, right? We were sending people over there on 9 month rotations from the U.S. Army or many, many associated like National Guard or Army Reserve units. A respected U.K. Defense Institute, and I don't know the nomenclature, but it's RUSI, estimated that between 2015 and January of 2022, the U.S.-led joint mission training Ukraine trained 27,000 Ukrainian personnel. Canada's Unifier trained 33,000. UK's Orbital trained 27,000. So basically, they did have all of these training centers on Ukrainian soil way before 2022, and add those up. 33,000 plus 27,000 is 60,000 plus 22,000 more. They trained 82,000 soldiers that we trained on Ukrainian soil, okay? After February of 2022, as Russia built up, Washington began to withdraw troops. 150 to 160 Florida National Guard troops from Ukraine were pulled out on 12th of February 2022 out of an abundance of caution. Within weeks of that is when Russia struck the base where they were located. The U.S. immediately reestablished the people they withdrew in the Joint Mission Training Group Ukraine mission in Germany at Grafenwöhr and Hohenfels. That's where the Combined Arms Battalion training and system-specific courses continued. And I think I know somebody, well, I know several people who are at Grafenwöhr and Hohenfels. I've been on both those bases years and years ago. After 2022, outside of Ukraine, Government Affairs Office said that 116,000 Ukrainians were trained outside of Ukraine by February 2024. 16% of them by the U.S. Combined arms, artillery, air defense, and system-specific training. That number climbed by 2024, May, to 127,000 across all partner nations. There are media reports that say that the CIA personnel also ran warfare and targeting instruction for select Ukrainian units after 2014. So the CIA was in operation in Ukraine after 2014, probably before that, probably participated in the Maidan takeover and overthrow of the government, just like I've been saying forever. And they ran this training. These accounts are based on unnamed sources, but they're widely discussed and never confirmed in official documents. Either way, overt documented DOD training footprints, you know, nobody disputes that we were there at least since 2015. But there's a lot of people say CIA was there before that. From the Russian point of view, this training tracks its central concern, what it said all along, shows the NATOization of Ukraine forces, doctrine, training protocols, leaders, years before 2022, years before. And the evidence that Moscow tells is that the West embedded itself in Ukraine's war-fighting architecture, not just in politics. So how does threading all these needles show how the pipelines are shifting? The West in 2014 to 2017, they called the aid to Ukraine is stabilization, border security, reform, and on the ground, the stuff that they provided, they were talking about radar, secure comms, optics, and advisors that make Ukrainian units harder to defeat. But that makes them also less dependent on Soviet legacy doctrines, right? Because now they're all being trained by Western people. From 2018 to 2021, the lethal elements came in. Javelins that Trump gave up, allegedly for deterrence. Patrol boats, better radar. The U.S. Lines were maturing. They were buying hardware and building institutions, training centers, doctrine stools, sustainments from Moscow's point of view. This was the decisive phase. The infrastructure of a NATO army was being laid inside of Ukraine. And from 2022 to 2025, once the shooting war expanded, the West ran the escalation ladder, just like they always do when they're trying to do regime change and push further toward Russia. They ran all the man pads and the ATGMs, the tube artillery, multiple launcher rocket systems, standoff missiles, jets. And Russia adapted with EW, decoys, dispersal, glide bomb tactics. The coalition that tried to plug the gaps, you know, the NATO, then they sent more interceptors, counter electronic warfare, deep strike money. The money trail just kept on going. So if we strip away all the spin and look at documents, what immediately jumped out at me was the continuity of the U.S. and its closest allies being in Ukraine, training, developing the ecosystem years before 2022, building a NATO familiar force at Yaroviv while steadily wiring, you know, the budgets to keep the train running. So when the war exploded, the rest of the pipeline switched from drip to fire hose. And, you know, they got rid of the people that were on site on the western side, but they kept pouring money in, and they did lots of procurement. So from the Russian perspective, this is not aid. that's on the margin. This is an operating system for Kyiv's military, funded in Washington, staffed by the West, standardized by the West, increasingly armed and long-range missiles given by the West, Storm Shadows, Scalps, Attackums, and then F-16s. Pentagon's ledgers and tables confirm the scope. You can dislike the fact that Russia and everybody else knows this and talks about it where the U.S. never does, but this wasn't just Russia crossing a line. We pushed it by money, by training them in NATO tactics, by building up their army, and made it ready to go. All ready. We laid the table and then expected nothing to happen. Meanwhile, they're bombing the hell out of their own country in the Donbass, and we just looked the other way for that. That doesn't make any, you know, what are we, why are we going to bother with that, right? I wanted to do, and I think I can do it in 15 minutes. I'm pretty sure I can. There's been some, and I actually have two little chunks that I wanted to talk about. Because I wanted to talk about these Ukrainian nationalists that I talked to you about in the beginning that have done a lot of killing. And I also wanted to go into Nord Stream. I think I will put Nord Stream off till tomorrow and investigate. Like I told you about Fico getting attempted assassination and four bullet holes by a Ukrainian. Well, there's been a pretty, I don't know, Ukrainian nationalists and pro-Ukrainian supporters who resort to murder, terror, sabotage. Since 2014, it's a pretty big international impact cases, you know, that come up. And some of them, like Crocus, if you remember that, was really you know, you know a decade after Maidan, with the Western backed overthrow of the sitting Ukrainian government, a decade after that, the landscape is, you know, pretty clear. Ultra nationalist currents that once lived on the margins in Ukraine, right sector, Azov military brigade, and assorted volunteer networks, they became battlefield legitimate. And then, now, they've got political cover. That isn't a value judgment, you know, by me. It's an operational reality. The Western press even acknowledges the far-right roots and symbols of the Azov formations. They later rebrand them inside the Ukrainian National Guard. Reuters bluntly stated that these Wolfsangel style insignia and swastika insignia and the movements of white nationalist origins came about long ago, and it's now officially part of the state structures. In that same period, we saw the normalization of targeted killings and infrastructure strikes outside the immediate front, first in Donbass in 2014 to 2017 when they were killing their own people. And anybody that said anything pro-Russia or not even necessarily anti-Ukraine, they were killing officials and leaders over there. They were targeted killings of people. And then they've done the same thing deep inside of Russia from 2022 to the present. And increasingly, they're doing them in other countries. Kyiv's own security leaders are usually pretty excited about it. GUR chief Kirill Budanov was quoted in 2023 saying, here's what he said, "We've killed Russians and will continue to kill Russians anywhere in the world." Later, he clarified it in the Kyiv media, but he said those words. Meanwhile, Mir Tvorets, that peacemaker alleged database, keeps public-style dossiers on enemies of Ukraine and notches them as liquidated after they're successfully killed. Human rights groups have criticized this long before 2022, but it's still going on. Against that, let's check out a few of the headlines of what has been tied to Ukrainian activities outside, or well, some inside of Ukraine, but most. Let's go to the Moscow City, or I'm sorry, the Crocus City Hall in Moscow on March 22 of 2024. They say that ISIS-K did the shooting, but Moscow says the Ukrainians had a hand in logistics. And what is hard fact? Four gunmen carried out massacre at Crocus City Hall, set the venue ablaze, and then fled. The death toll after hospitalization was 149, over 600 injured. It was Russia's deadliest terror attack. ISIS-K claimed responsibility immediately and even published attack footage. Trials began in August for 19 of the defendants tied to the case. Moscow says Russian security organs and the gunmen tried to escape toward Ukraine and that a window was prepared for them. Investigators said financing channels linked back to Ukraine. The Kremlin publicly framed it as an ISIS trigger pulled along supply lines connected to Kyiv services. Ukraine and the U.S., U.K. reject any Ukrainian involvement. But that doesn't address whether facilitators used Ukrainian territory to prepare. I say Crocus is most likely a hybrid case. They have plausible peripheral logistics to intersect what was going on in the war. These intersections are exactly where clandestine cooperation, safe houses, cutouts live. Even if Kyiv didn't have any foreknowledge, I doubt that. I think they did. The FSB claims that an exfiltration route ran through Ukraine. It isn't outlandish to think about that, especially in a wartime geography. The significance is strategic. It lets Moscow argue that terror war and the Ukraine war are fused together. And many in the West waved that away far too quickly. Let's talk about the cross-border campaign into Belgorod, Kursk, and the doctrine of making Russian civilians feel the war, okay? And I've got a bunch of them in here, but I just thought of another one. You know, I only picked three, and I didn't see this on the list that I was picking from. But there's another one that took place in Crimea on the beach when they sent cluster rounds to the beach on a Sunday afternoon. And let cluster rounds blow up on the beach, killed a good number of people, but those were fired. Those were fired by the military. Kyiv military did that. I say that's terrorism myself. But here, there's a multi-year stream of rocket, missile, and drone strikes into Belgorod. Russia's border has been repeatedly hit. 2023 strike killed 25 and wounded 100. It was the worst civilian loss of life from foreign enemy fire on Russian territory since World War II. By July 24, Belgorod's governor said over 200 civilians have been killed and 1,100 wounded in the region. And the numbers, you know, have climbed up since 2025. Kursk, the same thing. The multi-week Ukrainian push into Russia's Kursk region was significant displacement and Russian casualty. The foreign ministry puts death at 56 civilians with 266 injured. Kyiv disputes aspects and want some sort of independent verification. But these aren't just raids. These are pressure and attacking Russian civilians to erode rear area normal, you know, life, right? During the election periods, March 2024, even Putin framed Ukraine's shelling and attempted border breaches during Russia's vote as a terror campaign against civilians. Western media treated it as electoral theater, but the barrage pattern and casualty data do exist. From Kyiv's point of view, these are lawful strikes on the rear of the enemy to reduce Russia's capacity. From Moscow's perspective, and pretty much from mine too, sustained fire into city centers and common apartment blocks is terror. structurally indistinguishable from, you know, pressure on home front. You know, I mean, I don't agree, but I could see blowing up some kind of a, I don't know, a gas depot or something like that. But you don't fire on the beach in Crimea with cluster rounds and not call it terror. You don't blow up an apartment building in Belgrade, or worse, a shopping mall. They did that a few times. They had the decapitation track, car bombs, IEDs, and shootings of pro-Russian personalities. This started in Donbass years before 2022 and expanded into Russia property. Pre-2022, high-profile separatist commanders Arsen Pavlov in 2016 and Mikhail Givy Tolstik in 2017 were killed by elevator bombs and shoulder-launched munitions. These hits widely attributed to Kyiv. Later reporting, including Western and Ukrainian insiders, openly tie such assassinations to the SBU, Ukraine, Fifth Directorate Operations. Whether you approve or not, the technique, you know, explosives, elevator traps, remote triggers, you know, are all part of it. Since 2022, they continue. August 2022, a car bomb killed Daria Dugina, and Russia blames the SBU-linked operatives. Kyiv says it's a symbolic target. Prominent pro-Russian commentator fits the PSYOP aims. Fits Budanov's "we'll keep killing them" as well. Vladlen Tatarsky, April 2023, St. Petersburg cafe bombing killed him and injured dozens. A Russian woman got charged domestically, but with Ukrainian backing. Targeted one person, but killed, you know, or injured lots and lots. Zakhar Prilipin, May 2023, car bombing in Nizhny Novgorod. He survived, but his driver was killed. Russian authorities blame Ukraine and accuse the declared political motives. These people, most of which were on the Miratvorets list, too. Stanislav Rzitsky, in July 2023, ex-submarine commander and draft official, shot while jogging in Krasnodar. Ilya Kieva, December 2023, former Ukrainian MP, labeled a traitor, shot dead in Moscow. Oleg Tsarev, October 23, pro-Russian Ukrainian ex-MP, shot and wounded in Crimea. Occupied territory officials in Kherson and Zaporizhia face a sustained assassination campaign starting in mid-22 of car bombs, IEDs, and shootings, and even Western outlets track a dozen plus attacks on collaborators, frequently described by Kyiv-friendly media as partisan justice. The methods the same: bombs under seats, near doors, roadside devices. You know, you got the Miratvorets, and we, you know, the big ticket infrastructure, Crimean Bridge, the Kerch Bridge, has been hit multiple times since 2022, and that's a civilian target. You know, it's if that's fair game, you know, I guess you're all there. We talk about Trump and Fico being shot by Ukrainian activists, Nord Stream getting blown up by the Ukrainians. Patterns, quite a few of them. And there's rear area civilian tolls, targeted killings are constant. Earlier playbook is continual, and the ideological is always there. These ultranationalists, the ecosystem that the West, you know, initially downplayed, or it was inconvenient, you know, and they didn't like to talk about it, but they even took assistance from the Azov battalions for a while, but then they lifted that ban in 2024, normalizing what would have been taboo pre-war. They just said they were a terrorist organization. And then they, oh, well, give them money anyway. The Poles refused to do anything about it. And I wanted to share that article with you. But looks like we are running out of time. I appreciate you being with me tonight. I'm Samuel Trapp. This is International Flavor. We're on Dam Radio every night from 9 p.m. to 10:30 Central Standard Time. That's Chicago. And all of my shows are recorded and put on internationalflavor.com shortly thereafter. I appreciate you joining us on the program. Tomorrow is Wednesday, the longest day of radio for Dam Radio. Please join us and with several shows. I'll be back again tomorrow night. I very much appreciate you being here, and have a very good night.